on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, the young bull leading the way for one unique Tasmanian cattle property.
We are now serious stud breeders and we're aiming to always increase our quality, and we're now getting recognition from the mainland. And when we initially imported breeding stock from the mainland, we are now selling back to other studs on the mainland.
And transitioning the farm to a new owner to secure its future.
It's a very, very steep learning curve. Yeah, it's a steep learning curve for both of us, for all of us.
To know that Neville and Annette have literally created something that's going to be for generations to come if we continue with it. And that's my job.
Yeah, transitioning the farm to a new owner with the current owners, helping to mentor in the process, which will continue for the next few years. That story coming up on this Tuesday. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on Cup Day. Also coming up, we'll meet the champion bull in his class at this year's Royal Hobart Show. Very handsome Highland bull named Gilbrook is helping his owners in their Penna farm really establish their reputation as an excellent stud farm. More changes to the BOM website as the feedback continues, and we'll talk about that in just a moment, as well as check in with the Bureau locally at the halfway stage of the program to see what the rainfall figures are like. Here at the ABC Hobart Studios, we received 30 millimetres of rain up until midday. Let us know what's in your gauge. 0438922936, that number, 0438922936. The weather is where we start. And the Bureau of Meteorology has made some changes to the colour of the radar and flagged that more changes are on the way as the backlash continues from its website upgrade. Many users have used the old or legacy website, which is reg.bom.gov.au, but there are concerns about how much longer it will remain active, and others are worried about the cost involved in developing the controversial new site. Warwick Long spoke to General Manager of Environmental Prediction Services at the BOM, Matt Calopi, and started by getting the details of the new radar.
The key change was really to move the default. So you could already on the display on the new website find the radar reflectivity, often referred to as the DBZ, but the default was actually set to what you call the rainfall rate in millimetres per hour, which was what is on our app at the moment. So we had that common sort of display between the app and the new website. But after a lot of community feedback and people being familiar with the display that is reflectivity, we actually changed that default. So you could already find it there, but we changed the default.
So the colour rate was what changed, but you've gone from one setting to the other.
The display is slightly different. So the colours are fairly similar, and you can see the sort of legend there that tells you from sort of light rain through to moderate and heavy rain. The difference is in a rainfall rate, millimetres per hour, it on occasions won't pick up the really intense reflectivity echo. So for example, if you've got hail in a massive thunderstorm, that hail will spike really strong reflectivity values, and it'll show those colours in that red or even black end of that sort of really strong reflectivity. Now, of course, if it's hailing, is really significant for severe weather, but it doesn't actually show up as rainfall because it is literally hail and solid water. So it's a slightly different way of looking at the radar, but the community feedback was really strong on that. People wanted to see that reflectivity or that DBZ scale and display, so we changed that back on Friday.
So is this latest change, and there's been a few others in terms of what you can see when you, get onto the main website and where the links are, etc. Is it an admission that things weren't right, that some of these changes were mishandled by the Bureau?
I think you've seen over the past 18 months or so, 15 months in fact, we've had a beta available in the public domain so people can test it. We've had sort of initial focus groups of over 2,000 people doing that testing. And then as it was in beta, we had over 700 different specific sort of users that were giving us feedback. But the reality is you take all that in, you've got it online for people to look at in advance. But as you go public and you see 2 million people looking at that site, every day, you're always going to get additional feedback, and we're basically responding to that. So yes, it is an admission that we've got additional feedback now as it's gone public, as it's gone live, and we're responding.
Does it cost money every time you make a change like this since the new website has been up?
This one with the radar, et cetera, was one that our internal sort of IT teams, the data and sort of digital teams that we have, could do. So those people, you know, obviously have a range of duties to do, but there's no specific additional cost on that.
Other changes expected to happen to this website now? Obviously, you've made this change here on the radar. There's been an enormous amount of feedback over multiple amounts of different parts of that website. So is more expected here?
I think the key is there are certain specific feedback points, like how we display locations and the map itself and so on. And some of the things like seeing the radar kind of coverage map, which I think people gave. So those specific feedback points are certainly things that we can incorporate into the sort of future releases as we continue to upgrade and update the website. And then there are other things where we just need to really explain and work, probably do a better job of working through and explaining the different navigation features and the advantages and the differences between the old website and the new website.
Criticisms we've been getting quite extensively, the radar information becoming more vague, a lot of the data being washed out of the site, one example being fire danger ratings. Now, you still have the high, moderate and extreme, but the actual number used to be displayed next to that so people could to delve into just how bad that fire danger rating is. That's not there anymore. And other stuff, as you've just alluded to, being hard to find. So in terms of that scale of feedback, you know, are some things going to be looked at and others just being thought of as the public needs to learn?
I think just addressing the fire danger behaviour index up front, that one is going to be changed. So we are looking and working with the emergency management authorities, the fire authorities, like CFA, to actually update that, not just for Victoria, but for the country. So that one, that specific one, will be addressed. And in terms of, again, just working through and saying, well, there's some things that have changed and the data's still there, but it's just displayed differently. So that will take time to get used to, and we do need to do a better job of really explaining that. And I think a lot of our sort of YouTube and other video and Facebook releases are working through some of that.
What about making it easier just to see multi-day views of forecasts where it used to be on one page for a region or a town, and now you've got to click through? Are considerations being made there?
That is a really good one, because some of the feedback and when we got with the design was people just, they're really interested in their location. So that's why when you come into the page, it says, where do you want to see information for? And you put in, Ararat, and Ararat brings up all the information for your area, and you work through that. But I understand that people in some cases want to look at a whole bunch of towns across Victoria. That is something we'll have to consider and understand how we can best display that in a sort of accessible and logical way.
Whilst all of the feedback's been going on social media, there's been a lot of sharing of the fact the old website, I think you refer to it as a legacy website, is still up there, reg.bomb.gov.au. There's a lot of concern about how long that will stay up there. Do you have a timeline for how long that website will exist for?
Now, at this stage, there's no set date to turn off the legacy website. So we'll gradually continue working on the new website and updating information and moving some of the information across onto the new website. But there's no date to turn off that legacy, the old website.
And I'm not sure if you're the right person to ask this for, but we've heard from the Bureau the cost for this website upgrade was $4.1 million. There's been a lot of reporting, I'm sure you've seen over the weekend, of it being well upwards of 75, even more than $85 million in a website rebuild as well. Do you have any update on that figure that you could share?
No, the figure that we put out publicly that this redesign cost around $4 million, $4.1 million, is accurate. The reporting on the weekend, I'm not sure exactly where they pulled those numbers from, but they're not accurate in terms of the cost of designing this new website for the public.
So you don't know the reasoning for the discrepancy there?
No, I don't understand where they've got those much higher numbers from in the article that came out over the weekend.
General Manager of Environmental Prediction Services at the BOM, Matt Cullopy, speaking to Warwick Long about changes to the BOM website. Now, I've got a text from John. Says, hi, Tony, 51 mil from Sunday evening till this morning. Don't know where though, John. And he says, we have sunshine now. Let me know where you are. That'd be great. And we'll talk to the bomb a little bit later in the program about the amount of rain. Now, if you build a business literally from the ground up, it's no easy thing to hand over the reins. But Annette and Neville Reed want to see the new owner of their heirloom tomato farm succeed. So they're mentoring former Sydney investment advisor Predrag Reznik on his journey. Larissa Smith called into their Selborne farm to see this unique transition at work.
Yeah, this is what I was showing you. But this little guy,
red fig,
two days ago was up to here.
Yeah.
And this was what happened within 48 hours.
Yep. And you can see down the bottom there how quickly now you've got to get to your weeding here and your pruning here and get that up to here.
Yeah.
Because your plant's getting away from you.
Yeah.
And getting that staked, because if you're going to be opening the sides now and you do get the wind, you could have that snap off. Yeah, so that's crucial.
Yeah, these three.
Yeah.
And you think you have time, but you actually don't. For us, it's important to see that they're all nice, lush and green. I'll bet that really depends on variety, and I have learned that as well, that some of the varieties that are blue will have blue spots on the leaves from the very early stages, which I would personally maybe see as a fault in a plant, but it's not. We also have certain varieties that I've learned are called hearts, that usually they would look like they constantly need water and they're just about to die because they hang down. They don't look very happy, but they're extremely happy as plants. So a lot of that has been kind of a conundrum for me to unravel and to say, okay, well, there is around 160 different varieties that we planting this season, right? All of them have their own story. All of them have their own particular way of expressing in fruit, in aromas, in tastes. So we have a purple, we have a red, and we have a blue growing in symbiosis together, right?
I notice very different things when I walk into a tunnel that we haven't got to with Predrag yet. Yeah. So the first thing I see when I come in, given the height of the tomatoes and we're at the point where we know that pruning and staking is really important. So I look down here and I see a tomato that's coming up on either side of the trellis. And I know that I've got to get that over there to one side so that I don't so that the tomato doesn't split down the middle. So we're looking at little details that are the next step for Predrag now that the tomatoes are in.
What additions have you made since you've moved to the property?
So we've built an additional 11 polytunnels. So to basically double up the production, we have done some minor upgrades along the old ones. And basically, we're doing more on digital front for our new brand to be established and for this knowledge that they have accumulated to be not only passed to me, but the customers as well, so that we can educate them that tomato is not only a red small one cherry that you find in rows of supermarkets. There's a lot more of them. They grow phenomenally well in Australia. And to know that Neville and Annette have literally created something that's going to be for generations to come if we continue with it. And that's my job. This year, we are ideally expecting between 10 and 12 tons of produce, which is probably pretty much double what they've been doing for the last couple of years. And that's very exciting in itself. So we have a lot of chefs that are showing interest from the mainland to get the produce, to start working with it. And if we continue to do that, ideally, we would come to a point where we would have a hectare under polytunnels, which would be different type of polytunnels. They would be larger, all in one section, more uniform, so that you would have the workflow much more operationally viable so that less people can do more.
What's your background?
Background, so I'm originally from Croatia. I moved to Australia a long, long time ago, and I've been working in finance industry for the last 18 years. So I've been in asset management. I've been managing vast amounts of money for very rich clients and institutions. And I have done a lot of infrastructure deals as well, coupled with agriculture. Basically, my wife and I, a couple of years ago, decided to do something different, right? We have a huge passion for food, for high-quality ingredients, and we wanted to do something with food. We just didn't know what. And as a luck, or maybe not luck, maybe destiny, we were trying to cook a recipe which required three different types of tomatoes, right? And we discovered Neville and Annette's place, and I called them and I said, okay, I'm just going to be very direct here and ask for all these three varieties. And she says, yeah, sure, I have them. And I was like, what? How? Like, you can't even find them in Europe, nonetheless in here. So she shipped the tomatoes first time to us to Sydney when we tasted them. And we were like, okay, wow, what is this, right? And then we asked them, what's your plan? What are you going to do with this? And they said, look, we're actually scaling down. We're probably going to try to retire soon. We would love to sell the place if we can. And this is where the story sort of started. And a year later into it, I'm here.
Annette, how's he traveling?
It's a very, very steep learning curve. Yeah, it's a steep learning curve for both of us, for all of us. So
this is a couple-year transition.
It's a 3 to 5 year transition. We just see how it goes. We see how quickly we can pass on what we need to Predrag, and for us to be able to stay on our farm, to be able to bring someone else in and to be able to help them transition up as we transition down and out, it's a really good compromise.
What will you miss the most?
What will I miss the most? I miss my customers. That's what I'll miss. You know, this is not an easy job. Sometimes it's just darned hard work. But the thing that always brings us back, the thing that always makes us smile, gets us up in the morning, yeah, just makes us know we're doing something good here. It's our customers. It's the joy that what we do brings to other people. That's absolutely paramount. Tasmania is gardeners and tomato gardeners, ultimately, yeah. And I mean, we've been doing our seedling sale for the last month, and that's so clear. And you know, I had a fella come in yesterday, and he just looked around at the few tomato seedlings we've got left, and he said, "This is just amazing." We all want tomatoes in our backyard, and so there, you know, there's such a connection there throughout the whole process of growing tomatoes and garlic, I might add. Yep.
Tomato grower Annette Reid talking to Larissa Smith, passing on the baton to Predrag Rusnik, the new owner of the family-run business just north of Hagley. Couple of texts. John says he's at Kingston where they got 51 mil. Thanks, John. Jim says, ridiculous waste of money by Bomb in changing the website. Thank you for that too, Jim. 0438 922 936 is that text line number. Coming up, we'll talk about trade and the need to veer away from sending so much stuff to China.
Drive with Lucy Braden.
A prominent Tasmanian architect tells us why we need to preserve our Art Deco buildings.
Drive with Lucy.
Now we're talking.
Back today from 4 p.m. on 936 ABC Radio Hobart.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
The National Farmers Federation has called for Australia to do more to develop trade opportunities outside China. China is Australia's largest single export market, but the share of other Asian markets is growing. Ahead of a trip to the Southeast Asia, Interim Chief Executive Sue McCluskey tells Thomas Ariti more needs to be done to leverage opportunities in markets like India.
We've got to be careful not to be overly reliant on any market. And of course, it's a number of our sectors have seen in the past. A market can shut down overnight. We saw that with barley, with wine, with rock lobsters. And that was into China, of course. So having other markets that we can pivot quickly to be able to look at those opportunities is critically important for us.
Other markets to pivot to. So what are the key opportunities that you see in Southeast Asia and India that you think we should explore?
Well, in Southeast Asia and India in particular, there's a growing middle class, you've got growing demand, you've got a greater ability to pay, and you've got a growing awareness around safety, particularly food safety, and that is where Australia is really well positioned to be able to provide and supply into those markets.
I mean, the government says it's trying to do that, right? It's trying to expand trade links. And we saw Southeast Asia last week, for example. There was a lot of talk about building trade relationships with that region. So do you feel as though there are steps being taken in that regard? Is that a good start?
Look, it is a good start, and the government, of course, have, you know, they're the ones that are in there negotiating free trade agreements, and we do have a number of free trade agreements in Southeast Asian markets. But there's just a huge opportunity to really grow this opportunity and, you know, and be able to take a take advantage of it. And I will actually be co-leading a trade delegation next week to Indonesia and Brunei.
Yeah, that's right. You go to Brunei and Indonesia, right? I was going to ask about that. What will you be doing? Who will you be speaking to? What's the focus of the trip? Tell us about that.
Well, it's a strategic agribusiness mission to Indonesia and Brunei. Of course, we have a great relationship with Indonesia, but, you know, there's an opportunity to grow this fourfold. And so into Brunei as well, there's great opportunities to see how we can actually strengthen the ties. Being there in person is critically important because it's building those relationships. It's building the trust that really relies, you know, on the trade and market access into the future. So we'll be travelling with a number of our members and other agribusinesses to be able to meet with government officials, with other businesses on the ground, and just be able to explore in more detail what practical steps can be taken to be able to fully leverage on the opportunity that are presented.
Just on that, there are reports that the EU Trade Commissioner will shortly travel to Australia to continue negotiations on that Australia-EU free trade agreement. And people might remember the government walked away from those EU trade talks a couple of years ago, back in 2023. Do you support the resumption of those talks with Europe? And what will you be watching for this time around?
Look, you know, we certainly support resumption of negotiations with the EU in relation to a free trade agreement. But we walked away from this deal for all the right reasons last time. It just was a deal that was not good enough, particularly for agriculture, and we've got to get a much better deal this time. So that's really what we will be seeking, that we can get a better deal, and particularly around beef and sheep, but we've got to make sure that that is firmly on the table. We can't do a deal that is the same or very similar to what we walked away from last time.
National Farmers Federation Interim Chief Executive at Lisa McCluskey speaking to Thomas Aridi about how more trade opportunities outside China need to be developed. For the mining industry now, and Indigenous groups could form partnerships with major mining companies on multi-billion dollar projects, moving beyond agreements that just guarantee employment for Indigenous people. Billions of dollars from mining royalties have been accruing in trust funds built up over decades, and legislation has recently changed to enable that money to be invested by Indigenous groups. Jai Lawton, the CEO of Aboriginal Enterprises in Mining, Energy and Exploration, has told David Claughton as pastoral leases in WA expire, new royalty deals may be struck as right to negotiate provisions are triggered.
These agreements, and some of them, particularly the ones in the earlier days when you talk about, you know, some of this mining started in the Pilbara and in central Queensland in the 1970s, and so the agreements back then were done, you know, even pre-native title, pre-1992, and so those agreements are different for each group. And what tends to happen with those agreements is that as part of the access to the land for the use of the mining, negotiations are done, and a royalty payment is received as part of the benefit of having access to that land to be able to then transfer for generational wealth down the track. And so, yeah, there's different royalty schemes and different buckets of money that are sitting in trusts. And
some of them are worth billions.
Yeah, some of them worth billions, yeah. There's particularly in the Pilbara and up in the Northern Territory, where there's a lot of mining activity from you know, the Groot Island, where they've got the largest manganese deposit in the world. They've got large trusts and a lot of dollars in those trusts, and the conditions of releasing and deploying that money to community are also quite challenging, because you've got sort of different trust structures that are quite complex and aren't always deployed down into the communities that they're meant to serve.
So that money's just sitting there, not actually having an impact.
Yeah, some of it. Yeah, some of it is having an impact in other areas. In the Western Cape, they've got a trust that they're able to invest in supporting Indigenous businesses from that local area, or educational scholarships and stuff like that. But yeah, some of the sad cases is there's just trust fund money sitting in there that's not being deployed.
What about, let's go back to this idea of partnerships with Indigenous businesses, right? What are some of the ones that are working, you know, where maybe the mining companies are co-investing, or they've got like a stake? This is something you talked to me about before, that maybe that's a different model that could be employed as well.
Yeah, and that's certainly the future. There's not too many of them now. There's a lot happening in the renewable energy space, obviously smaller capital and investment infrastructure required for renewable energy companies, but now we're starting to see how does that look in terms of large-scale mining operations. So, and by partnership, that is, you know, having taking a co-equity or investment stake into the project.
So that's an Indigenous group that might own 10 or 20% of a mining project, right? And then they would be involved in partnering with another Indigenous company to deliver some of the services.
Yeah, or going as an investor. So, you know, not too many of these companies have the money to do the projects from end to end, and so they go out to the capital markets and attract investors. And so what we're saying is, why can't an Indigenous prescribed body corporate attract capital to then invest into those projects? So that's the sort of the stuff we're looking at now. And through places like Indigenous Business Australia, they're able to actually now, the legislation's been removed to go out to the external markets and raise capital. And when they raise that capital, they have to deploy the capital somewhere, and so they can then invest in major projects with traditional owner groups.
Will that change the look of mining companies and you know, who owns them in the future?
Absolutely. So if you look at the way it's done now in terms of royalty scheme, if you actually went to look at what the return of that investment is in regards to what the money they're getting out of the royalty scheme, for the return on that investment would be 0.001%, versus if you're going in as a co-investor, the project will see returns, and those returns, depending on the commodity, are anywhere from 10 to 20% plus.
That's Jai Lawton, CEO of Aboriginal Enterprises in Mining, Energy and Exploration Limited, an incorporated not-for-profit company set up to grow Indigenous businesses in Australia and overseas in mining. And he was talking there to David Claughton. Still to come on today's edition of The Country Hour, we meet the champion Highland Bull, and we'll talk the mice plague, what's about to happen possibly, plus a check on the weather. First up, the news headlines with Alison Costello.
Thanks, Tony. Making news, an order allowing a multi-purpose stadium be built on Hobart's waterfront has been introduced in Tasmanian Parliament. It's expected to pass easily through the lower house with support from both major parties, but it requires the support of three upper house independents to pass the Legislative Council, with a vote to be held in the first week of December. Home loan borrowers are widely expected to miss out on a Melbourne Cup Day interest rate cut when the Reserve Bank announces its decision this afternoon. The likelihood of a November rate cut was as high as 81% a fortnight ago, but the chances have slumped to just 7% amid higher than expected inflation data. Police are hoping to speak to two women who were spat at in Launceston CBD on Sunday. A 32-year-old man was arrested by an off-duty police officer shortly after the incident, which happened at 12:30 p.m. He was charged with a string of offences, including possession of a knife, but police particularly want to get in touch with these two women. And the 165th running of the Melbourne Cup is just a few hours away, albeit under wet conditions. The track's had 35 millimetres of rain in 24 hours. It hasn't deterred racegoers, though, Tony, who've turned out in their thousands, tens of thousands.
Thanks, Alison. Talking rain, we've had 30 mil of rain here at the ABC Hobart Studios. And to check what else is happening with the rainfall, check the latest on the weather as well, Ursula Connor joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Ursula.
Good afternoon, Tony.
You got some rainfall figures for us?
Yeah, well, we had the rain really start over the state on sort of Sunday night. So since then, we had around over 30 millimetres pick up through large parts of the south of the state, through the Central Plateau and pushing into the Western Tiers as well. So our highest figures being Grove picking up 47.6 millimetres, Hobart itself saw 34.8 millimetres. Through Launceston, Burnie, Devonport area was more around the 15 millimetre mark. Strawn in the west got up to 26.2 millimetres and not too much making it through to the northeast. St Helens was our lowest recorded, 3.6 millimetres for them, Tony.
So has the rain gone away?
The rain band has largely cleared off to the south of the state now, and including that overcast cloud. But now as we move into the afternoon, with all that moisture around, we'll start to see some more convective sort of afternoon showers and possibly even a few thunderstorms picking up, particularly about sort of the southeast, central parts and the northwest of the state. But into this evening, we'll see this low pressure system making its way across Tasmania, and a westerly change through behind that sort of late tonight and into tomorrow morning. So that'll see our winds increasing and those showers contracting mainly back to the west of the state for Wednesday and Thursday, although we still could see a few of those afternoon showers across the state again tomorrow. Into Friday, we'll see a low developing over the southeast of the mainland. So that'll bring a few sort of slow-moving fronts and some easterly rain over the state. So hopefully those parts of the northeast that might have missed out on the bigger totals in the last few days, we'll pick up a bit of rain on Friday, Tony.
And what about the weekend? What are we looking at?
Yeah, as we move into the weekend, we'll likely see a few showers lingering sort of on Saturday morning, especially about the northern half of the state, just as that low moves away. But then we have a ridge developing sort of on Saturday afternoon and pushing in over the state, which should clear up most of those showers, just a few light showers sort of about the west for the rest of the weekend.
And warnings, what have we got?
We currently have a strong wind warning for western and northern coastal waters. That one extends from southeast Cape to Wineglass Bay. We also have a warning to sheep graziers for King Island, the Furneaux Islands, the northwest coast and the upper Derwent Valley. That one's for today and tomorrow as we start to see those strong westerly winds increase. That will also cause tomorrow to see that strong wind warning extend to all of the coastal waters, including most of the southeast inshore waters as well. And we see that increase to a gale wind warning for those westerly winds for the southeast coast, Tony.
So what's the outlook for the coastal waters and swells?
Yeah, we've currently got west and northwesterly winds around sort of 15 to 25 knots. They'll be increasing to 30 knots and tending southwesterly as we move into the evening, although about the southeast, it's a bit more variable, sort of below 10 knots. And then as we move into this afternoon, that'll tend more north to northeasterly at 10 to 20 knots. As we move into tomorrow, as I mentioned, those westerly winds increasing. They'll be picking up to around 25 to 35 knots throughout, except for about the east coast, where it'll be more like 15 to 25 knots. In terms of the swells, there's a few swells around caused by all these different directions from the low pressure system. So in the west, we're looking at a southwesterly of 2 to 3 metres and a southerly of 1 metre. In the south, a southwesterly of 1 to 2 metres and a northeasterly of 1 to 2 metres. In the north, we've got a westerly around 1 to 2, and in the east, a southerly of 1 to 2 metres and a northeasterly of 1 to 2 metres.
And the wave riders with the maximum wave heights, if that's possible?
Yes. The Cape Sorrelboy is currently sitting on a southwesterly, has a significant wave height of 2.7 metres at the moment. And Maria Island's picking that northeasterly, currently sitting at 1.5 metres.
Thank you for that, Ursula.
Cheers, Tony. Have a good one.
You too. Cheers. Ursula Connor from the Bureau with the latest information for you on the weather. We'll meet the champion Highland Cattle Bull in just a moment.
The race that stops a nation. Live and ad-free coverage of the 2025 Melbourne Cup from Flemington. Today from 2:30 on 936 ABC Radio Hobart.
On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, the feature cattle at the Royal Hobart Show this year were Highland cattle, so it's fitting a Highland bull won a major award in the cattle judging. I took a trip out to the farm to meet the bull and his owners.
Craig McSwain, and we're at Penner, Sharp Point Road in Penner, at our property where we run Craigie Island Highlands.
Yes, I'm Alison Scott, and yes, we breed Scottish Highland cattle here on our 100-acre farm.
And you had a very good result at the Royal Hobart Show. Tell us about that, Alison.
Yes, for the first time, Highland cattle received a Grand Champion Interbreed Award in the beef cattle section at the Highland Show. We're exhibiting our Black Bull Gilbrook in the Senior Bull section. And, he was awarded Grand Champion Interbreed Bull this year.
And a fantastic result because the Highland cattle were the feature cattle of the show.
Yes, they were the feature breed this year, and which was really good because we've sort of been working in the last few years to get the numbers up at the show. So to be feature breed this year was a good acknowledgement of that. And, yeah, we managed to get five studs to the show this year, and I think 22 animals, which is a big number for Highlands in Tassie.
I just took a photo of the bull, and he's very photogenic. He's beautiful, beautiful animal.
He is, yep, he is. We're very proud of to have him here. We've had him since he was...
we've had him 4 years.
4 years, yeah, so since he was 6 years old now. So we didn't breed him. We brought him in from the mainland, so he's bred in South Australia. But, yeah, we're very proud to be owners of him.
How big was he when you brought him here?
Well, a fair bit smaller, so he would have been probably around... maybe 300-400 kilos when we got him, and he's now at the show. He weighed in 826 kilos.
Alison, you had to lead him around the showground. Was that daunting?
He's a pretty quiet bull, so I know his temperament. And I've spent a lot of time with him, but he is also, I know how strong he is, and when you're in the ring with other testosterone-fueled bulls and young heifers, yeah, can be a little bit nervous on the inside, but we did okay.
What happens to him now with regard to his future? You had some comments from the judge who was from Queensland, which were pretty good comments, I believe.
Yeah, they were. Yeah, we had Troy down from Queensland. So we've been using him for a few years now, but we're going to keep him on. We're really happy with his progeny that he's given us, and we've actually brought in another bull from the mainland to go over some of his offspring. But we're keen to keep him going for a while. But some feedback we did get from the judge was to look at possibly collecting him and doing some work with his semen in the country and possibly even internationally. So that was some good recognition there.
Yeah, so collecting straws and sending them wherever.
Yeah, correct.
Overseas.
Yes.
Yep. Maybe to Scotland.
Well, yes, maybe. You never know. It's a pretty big thing for us to consider. We sort of weren't expecting that sort of feedback. So, we'll take it on board and see where that leads us.
Alison, what's the history here with the time you've spent setting up this beautiful farm? And just to let people know, when they fly in from anywhere else into Hobart Airport, if you look to the left, you can see it. Or you look to the right, if you're coming from the south, beautiful part of the world with the water surrounding it. Must have been magic when you first discovered it and thought, hey, we can have this.
Yeah, well, we weren't actually thinking cattle when we first found the property. Like, my mum was an avid horse rider, and I grew up with ponies and pony club and all that. So, and Craig was keen to have his own horse. So when we were living in Melbourne at the time, because Craig's from Melbourne. So we're just looking around for a horse property. So that's sort of what we thought at first. And then when we'd looked at a few other places and that were a bit smaller and a bit more in our budget, and then we saw this one was a little bit more than we were willing to spend, but yeah, it was magic, and we just fell in love with it when we first saw it.
And where did the Highland cattle come from, the decision to concentrate on them when horses would have probably been easier?
Yeah, we still have some horses, but I think at the time, there were a couple of reasons why we started looking at cattle. One of them was to help with some parasite control on the property. It was suggested to us that we get some cattle to help with that for the horses, basically. And we were adjusting the part of the property that the cattle are on were back to the family that sold us the property initially. And then we thought, maybe we should do something ourselves. So Highlands were never really on the radar. We sort of saw them by chance, I guess, on Gumtree. They were just Gumtree cattle to start with. We were actually looking for, not sure exactly what, some Belties or something. But then, I saw the Highlands and pretty much convinced Alison to have a go at them. So we got them, and then, we got the bug from there. And since then, we've worked hard to turn into a registered breeding stud and import stock from the mainland. So we've imported females from the mainland to get us going. Yeah, we're on our fourth mainland bull.
So what's the business plan? What actually happens with the cattle that you breed and the cattle that you sell? Who's buying them, and what are they buying them for?
Yeah, so we, because of the looks and you know, the cuteness factor of some of them, we do get a lot of inquiries from the hobby farmers who just want some friendly pets. And we will halter train all our sales animals so that they're suitable for that. But our main focus is we are now serious stud breeders, and we're aiming to always increase our quality, and we're now getting recognition from the mainland. And when we initially imported breeding stock from the mainland, we are now selling back to other studs on the mainland. So we have registered heifers, we'll sell them, and some bulls. So we've sold to Victoria and New South Wales, and possibly we'll have a bull going to Western Australia early next year. So,
boy, change around.
Yeah.
Our guests are Craig and Alison from Craigie Island Highlands at Penna. Where did the name come from?
I'm not sure exactly how we did it. It was a bit, I think we came up with a name. It was a bit of a play on my name, the fact that we'd got a lot of water around us with that island theme, but and Craigie Island from the, I'm not sure if people will know, I'll probably show our age a little bit, but there was a program called Father Ted and they lived on Craigie Island. It was a bit of a comedy. So yeah, we sort of strung that together. It never really was intended to be used as our business name or anything, but it stuck.
And, it stuck.
Yeah, it did stick.
You talk about water all around. What about water on the land? What's the situation?
Very dry. We're low rainfall property as it is. The last 2 years, sort of pretty much ongoing drought, and we've been relying on and hand feeding a lot. So we do struggle with that, and we do have to manage our numbers carefully to fall within those constraints.
What water have you got?
We have town water connected. We've got a bore that's been sunk. We've never used it, but we've got plans to. Yeah, that's and a water hole, and yeah, that's about it. So yeah, we do struggle for rainfall here, but yeah, we make do, and we've adjusted our program to suit as best we can.
I mean, the shoots of green around with the grass, and obviously, how many hectares have you got here?
We're on 40 hectares, and the cattle are on about half of it, aren't they? About 50-50. So yeah, they run on half of it, and yeah, we sort of try to manage our numbers better. We're probably overstocked as we sort of grew. We got in quite large numbers and then down selected from that and kept the best, which probably gave our breeding program a little bit of a boost, because we cut pretty hard from there. And
but they're pretty good when it comes to feed. They'll eat practically anything.
Yes, yeah, they're good foragers. They don't need anything special to do well. Their horns help them. They're part of their digestive system, and they will help them do well off more marginal pasture. So that
I suppose that's one thing that scares a lot of people off is the fact that they've got the horns, but they're very important to them, as you were saying there.
Yes, so they're part of their digestive system. They also have a role in thermoregulation, so controlling their temperature. So there are people that are breeding them with other cattle to come up with a polled breed, and they can be dehorned. But once you move the horns from an animal with long hairy coats like that and play around with their temperature system, that's something we'd rather leave them intact. Yeah.
And one thing I noticed about the bull, what was his name again?
Gilbrook.
Gilbrook.
Yep.
I couldn't see his eyes.
Yeah, we often get, when we're out showing or on display, we often get comments from the public, how do they see? It's a very common question. But they certainly manage all right. You know, he'll be able to spot you walking up, no problem at all.
Yeah, no, I know he knew the camera was on him before and he was posing away. Well, look, congratulations on what you're doing. It's obviously working. When you win show medals or show ribbons, it's good.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Tony, and thanks for taking the time and coming to see us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to come out to a property like this.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
Alison Scott and Craig McSwain, the owners of Craigie Island Highlands, where the bull Gilbrook took out a major award at the Royal Hobart Show. He's a beautiful-looking animal, black in colour. I'll put a picture of him up for you on our website a little bit later today with that story as well on our Taz Country Hour website and also on ABC Rural Facebook page as well. We shall talk about mice in just a moment.
Next on Breakfast, tricky conversation. A beloved family pet near the end of its life could live a month or two longer for $7,000. What would you do?
Rick Goddard.
Back tomorrow from 5:30 a.m.
on 936 ABC Radio Hobart.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Farmers are being urged to monitor for mice during harvest as the threat of a big increase in the pest population looms. Trapping by the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation has revealed much higher than usual numbers of pregnant females in key cropping zones. Steve Henry, research officer with CSIRO, says farmers need to get a sense of numbers now so they're prepared to act at sowing time in autumn next year.
We've just completed our spring monitoring run through most of the cropping zone. And while there are quite a few places where there are low or almost no signs of mouse activity, there are a couple of places where we were a bit concerned about what we were seeing. So certainly on the Adelaide Plains, where we had much higher trap success than we normally have at this time of the year, and all of the females that we caught during our trapping sessions showed signs of reproduction. That was a sign where we were quite concerned. But also areas like the Wimmera in Victoria and to a lesser extent, some of the places in northern New South Wales, southern Queensland, the Darling Downs, for instance. At the moment, we're not seeing very much activity there, but that doesn't mean that they're not there. So we're really advocating that people take a watching brief as we go forward to harvest and then into the stubble.
And for those areas, particularly northern New South Wales, southern Queensland, bumper crop, heavy stubble loads, I suppose there could be a lot of feed over that summer period for those mice.
Yeah, absolutely. And barley's one of those crops that's a real alarm for us because it is a big crop. We see some really big yields, say 5 and 6 tonne yields, that do leave a fair amount of grain behind, either because of wind abundance prior to harvest or just simply processing such big crops, lots of biomass. So all of those things add up to really good environment for mice. So lots of biomass left behind, lots of cover for mice, but also lots of grain in amongst all of that shelter, so ideal conditions.
So just taking a step back with those really high pregnancy and reproductive numbers, what does that mean looking forward to the autumn time when mice can be most problematic?
If we get an average or even better, slightly better than average harvest and a wet summer, that provides a scenario where mice could potentially keep to breeding through the stubble phase and be there in high numbers when we're sowing the next crop next April. So really important to manage the stubble phase, know what's going on there and be prepared to take action if we start to see high numbers.
So at this time of the year, it's about monitoring and getting a sense of numbers rather than actually going out and baiting?
Yeah, I think that we're so close to harvest now that we probably won't see the kind of numbers in the current crop that will cause significant damage at harvest. It's more about, you know, being prepared to take action as we see numbers increase in the stubble.
And it might be hard to talk in general terms, but what is generally best practice when it comes to baiting regimes around sowing time in the autumn?
Yeah, so we know, you know, we would like farmers to have access to the 50-gram bait, but we don't. So what we do know about the current bait strength is that it's way more effective if there's less food in the system. So it's a bit like, it's almost common sense. The less other food that you have in the system, that gives mice the best chance of discovering the 2 or 3 grains that they need to get a lethal dose. So harvesting as clean as possible is critically important. If you've got sheep as part of your system, use them to graze the stubbles to reduce the background food for mice. And then bait as you're sowing the next crop, because the act of sowing the crop actually buries a lot of that residual food, and then that gives mice the best chance of finding those grains if you've spread them as you're sowing the crop. When they pop up after the crop's sown, all the other food's been buried, the first thing they find is those baits on the surface. It's really important for them to get out, have a look, work out what the situation is, and it's pretty easy to do in a stubble. You can walk a couple of hundred metres and count all the burrows, active burrows in that 100 metre strips, and then multiply up to burrows per hectare, and that'll give you a really quick rule of thumb about how many mice you have. So if you've got one burrow per 100 square metres, that's 100 burrows per hectare, and if there's about 2 mice per burrow, then that's not an unreasonable assumption. Then we know then you've got 200 mice per hectare, that's the time to start taking action.
So, Steve, you're issuing a word of warning, but you're not using terms like potential plague.
No, we're not, and we're always a bit reluctant to do that. We don't want to take an alarmist approach, but what we want to say to farmers is that there's a whole lot of factors that are starting to stack up together that we should be really starting to be on a higher alert than normal. So be prepared, get out, have a look, know what's going on in your stubbles and be prepared to take action.
And your approach or your level of caution, does that come down a bit to lived experience? If say, for example, in relatively recent times you went through the New South Wales plague, have you perhaps got that fresh in your mind and you're more on alert than someone who maybe hasn't experienced a plague for a long time?
I think that that's a really valid approach. I mean, what happened in New South Wales is, you know, they hadn't had a plague for about 10 years. And at the point where they're saying, oh, gee, I'm seeing a few mice, but they're probably not much to worry about. The point at which they're seeing a few mice is the time to start to take action. We know that mice breed so quickly that, you know, if you've got 100 mice per hectare and 50 of those are females, and they're having 6 to 10 babies every 19 to 21 days, it doesn't take very long to go from, gee, I'm seeing a few mice, to, man, I'm overrun by mice. I guess the only other thing to say is that it doesn't take very much food to feed a lot of mice. So 150 kilos per hectare left behind after the harvest is the equivalent of 50,000 mouse days. So, yeah, you know, I hear stories of a whole lot more food than that. But if you've only got 150 kilos per hectare, that's enough to feed 1,000 mice per hectare through 50 days of summer.
There's some big numbers there. Steve Henry, Research Officer with CSIRO, speaking with Angus Furley about mice activity in the lead-up to harvest. I'll put a podcast of today's program up for you shortly. Don't forget ABC Rural online or our ABC Rural Facebook page. And there will be another country hour tomorrow after midday.